Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
To Outcasts with your new limited edition David Berry and mass-produced, using whatever they found on the floor that day, Tim Downey. On Outcast today, we have just had that little bit too much Emmental before bedtime and are now locked in a sweaty fever dream where rabbits run all the world's major transport links and that Roger from Outlander is Minister for Everything, beginning with the letter Q. Yes, we all know him as Tricky Dicky. It's Housewives' Choice. Richard Rankin, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Good morning, gentlemen. It's an honour and a privilege to be here. Thanks for having me as your guest.
Absolute pleasure.
Wow. Absolutely. That's very, very dignified.
I thought about that line. I thought, when they welcome me on the show, what am I going to say to sound sophisticated and relatively intelligent? I came up with that. I listened to many podcasts to find out what the average response was, and it was something like that.
Worked on every level. I felt moved and included, and it was nice. This is going to go extremely well, I think, if this is how we begin.
Oh, don't doubt it.
Well, fantastic. Well, Richard, as you know, what we like to do is to get a scene that you've chosen in advance. You sent us a scene. When we received it, we were a little bit perplexed, to be honest. We were like, is Richard having us on? Is this the scene that he really wants us to read out? Tim, you want to go into the reasons why?
Well, it doesn't include Roger. It talks about Roger, but it doesn't include Roger.
I think that's the best way for Roger to feature. Sure, to be fair.
Almost a bit like Gatsby, as in he's talked about a lot. You don't see him. You build the tension. Where is he? What's he done? Where's he gone? Did you see him? No, I didn't see him. I did, though. But this is from episode 4. Do you want to give us a bit of a run-up, Rick, as to why you chose this scene? Why in Please. Particular? What is it about this scene?
Tell us why.
Why I chose this scene. I mean, it's not entirely randomly chosen, if that's what you're going to insinuate. I haven't basically just skimmed through several episodes and thought, that'll do. No, you wanted a scene preferably with several characters, and I thought that it might be quite fun to find a scene with Jamie and Claire. Might be fun, you know, because I'd imagine you'll have a lot of fans listening and they like a bit of Jamie and Claire. And Brianna, because that relates more to my sort of time within the show. I didn't want to do Roger because I thought, I've had enough of him. So I thought, what other characters could we do that don't feature my character? Because like you said, build up the mystery of Roger. He's kind of mysterious, best kept off screen. So I thought, let's keep him off podcast too. And I remembered the scene with Jamie, Claire and Brianna, which later goes on to feature young Ian after Roger's disappeared and Brianna finds out that it was, in fact, at the hands of Jamie and young Ian. And I remember that being a really great scene, a really intense scene, and a scene which I thought might be a good ensemble, might lend itself quite nicely to be played around with on your podcast. Those are my reasons, really. There's not much more integrity to it.
Those are great reasons. You have a producer's mentality, a director's mentality, and I'm excited for it. You being the producer and the director, how about you choose, assign the roles?
Right. Well, I have heard on the grapevine, as a grapevine of many branches, I will admit, but I have heard that Mr. Tim Downey does a good Jamie Fraser, an exceptional Jamie Fraser.
He does.
You've heard correctly. I don't know who's been whispering, but it's good.
I am told even that Tim Downey's Jamie Fraser will spoil Jamie Fraser for, you know, going forward. No one will be able to listen to Sam Heughan's Jamie Fraser after they've heard Tim's. So, Tim, I offer you the role if you want to accept it.
Oh, God. Okay.
An Outlander. Oh, thank you. So good to have you on board.
I'll do it. Okay.
You are doing stage directions, David.
I knew it.
Well, Tim and I play the rest of the part. No, you obviously, who else could you have? I couldn't think of anyone better to play Claire than you, David, other than Katrina Balfe, obviously.
I was born to play. But, thank you.
Yeah. And I think since I actually initially back in the day auditioned for this part, I didn't get it, obviously. I should be playing Brianna. I don't know if you know that I auditioned for Brianna before Roger, but I did.
I think we all auditioned for Brianna.
I did have a bash. I just wasn't tall enough. Odd. But otherwise, I think I would have got it.
Yeah, I was told the same thing. I thought they were just trying to be polite. But I think they made the best choice in the end.
I think so.
And Murta, who's Murta?
I think you should audition for Murta, first of all. There's one line. Just whenever you're ready, if you could give us that one line and Tim and I will decide whether or not, you know, it's obviously not about ability, it's not about talent. We know that you have that, but some people just aren't right for the role. So it'll just be, you know.
You can tell me if it's not going to go my way. All right. The mash will be ready for distilling within a month.
Oh my God, was that Duncan LaCroix?
That's chilling. Absolutely chilling.
I felt like I was right there.
Is it supposed to be chilling? Hold your applause.
Is it supposed to be chilling? yeah, I think you've got the part, mate.
Thank you. Well, let's jump into it then.
Shall I take stage directions?
Please.
And then we can always mix it up as we go along. So just to be clear, it's David Berry playing, giving you his Murta. Tim Downey giving you his Jamie. And we have Mr. Richard Rankin giving you his Bree. And then obviously Mr. David Berry continuing with Claire. Me, Mr. Tim Downey, stage directions. Right, so episode 4, scene 13. Interior Fraser's Ridge cabin moments later. Day 20. Jamie, Claire, Ian, and Murta are fixing breakfast.
The mash will be ready for distilling within a month.
Hey, good. The next batch is almost ready for dist. Tom Burrell has already requested a cask.
Do you see how effective I am as Jamie?
I can't go back now. I can't go back.
You can't, can you?
No.
You just can't.
That's just how it should always have been.
Right, so, Brianna and Lizzie enter. Bree beelines for Jamie.
Where's Roger?
Claire looks up.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, Roger?
Continue to.
Lizzie told me that Roger came here and Jamie beat him.
She points at
Jamie. Hold the phone. Where is this Brianna from?
Well, I'm thinking somewhere in the valley, you know. Somewhere up there, kind of just beyond Burbank, about 5 miles north of Burbank, somewhere like that. Does that not work for you?
No. Is this based on a person that you know?
Is it based? No. Let's not judge yet. I do have choices. I'm coming to the table. I'm going to bring you alternatives, if you like. I'm going to start here. Just, you know, give it a moment.
Okay. We're at the top. We're going higher. That's what I've got from this. Right. She
I believe
points
this is
at
how
Jane.
Brianna should have been played. Apologies.
This is it. Not a problem. She points at Jamie. Ian stops mid-chew. Oh, shit.
I thought Roger went back.
So did I, but he didn't. Did he? What did you do to him?
Claire suddenly remembers something and looks at Jamie.
Your hand.
In her gut. She know Brianna's right.
Oh, my God. It's true, isn't it?
I think I'll wait outside. Come, lad.
No, he stays. He was involved in this too, weren't you, cousin?
Ian finally swallows his food. I'm glad about that. I was concerned because there's a lot of time that goes on where he's still masticating and he hasn't swallowed. It could be a choking incident. Murta's gone. It was tricky. Right. Ian finally swallows his food. Good. He nods. Murta exits.
Okay, we have to. What is going on with that sound? Does anyone else hear it banging?
It's a dog, and I'm going to move him. Please bear with me a moment.
Cut there.
Okay, this happens in takes.
This has happened before, where animals interrupt sequence scenes. I mean, I wouldn't have much of experience with that. Obviously, it goes without saying. But He's running around. He's running around.
You have notes. I have experience with that.
Sorry. I what? That wasn't my fault.
I literally have no idea what went on there, but I believe a dog was moved from one place to another swiftly.
You should cut that. You should cut that.
We'll. Yeah. I mean, wonderful. That is live podcasting for you. That right there. That's what's exciting. Is animals come in, they leave. You know, I want.
And they don't even care. They have
they
no just, consideration.
They, don't even care.
They have no care. They have no appreciation for the art.
Unbelievable. In the middle of your Brianna as well.
Right in the middle of my Brianna. What the hell?
Just before, I mean, I was writing character for Jamie for his next bit there. And now I'm thrown by some sort of rogue canine.
I apologize, guys. I realized I've destroyed the flow, and I apologize.
Not at all.
We'll pick it up. We'll pick it up, everyone. We'll pick it up. Okay. Has Ian swallowed his food? Okay, yes, Ian swallowed his food. Good. Ian finally swallows his food. He nods. Murta exit.
Jamie, what have you done?
Aye, I give the man a beating. If it was your historian, then I didn't ken it. You did see he left here. Even so, if he ravaged her, as Lizzie said, then...
He didn't. Lizzie was wrong.
A beat of silence as Jamie processes that. He didn't abed you.
No. I mean, yes, he did, but I wanted him to. We were handfast, and then we fought, and he left, and...
You bedded him for lust. Your city ripped you of your virtue.
He's disgusted. He mistakenly thinks it has been just one man.
I nearly killed the man. To think I was defending your honour, and now come to find your claim to have been violated upon finding yourself with child.
I've become a bit country, I've realised. A little bit sort of Highlandy, almost too much, or even slightly Lancashire. Which may have been a mistake. Maybe my lack of accent.
I nearly killed a man. I did to think I was defending your honour, and now come to find you claim to have been violated.
Come finding yourself with child.
Aye,
gives it a certain flavour.
I think it's good though. I think the genuine thrust is there, and I think that's important. Right upon. And upon the way, obviously, because this would be the next thing that I would do after that staggering performance for myself, Brianna slaps him, as well she should. And this time, he isn't ready, and he doesn't catch her hand. Young Ian watches in shock, having finally swallowed, and is not anywhere near a choking incident. He has swallowed his food good, and
he watches safe.
With shock. Ian is safe. The thrust of this scene has been, is Murta going to make whiskey? Is Ian going to swallow? And both of those things thus far have been proved correct. The side issue of Bree being violated will now be addressed.
I was violated, you self-righteous bastard, by someone else. You beat up the wrong man.
Silence. Jamie realizes his mistake and instantly hates himself. Brianna is crying now. Claire goes for her. Jamie knows Claire isn't in his corner right now. He's devastated by his error. To Claire, as it drew. Claire is nodding now, by the way. I'm sorry, lass.
Go to hell.
I'll make it right. My word as your father.
My father would never have said the things you said to me. He was a good man, and you're nothing but a savage.
Jamie knows the relationship is broken, maybe for good, but he needs to know if it wasn't Roger, then who? Claire set something on the table. Bit vague.
Him.
Ah, right. Sorry, I didn't read on. It's the ring. Her ring. I should have read on. The key to Lallybrook. Brock. The one Bonnet stole from Claire in episode 401. Jamie stares at it, instantly comprehending the implications, horrified. Bonnet.
Oh my God, yes. Now where the hell is Roger?
Young Ian stammers. We haven't even cast young Ian.
I got it. I'm going to jump in.
Do it. Go for it. Go. Give me your young Ian.
Wait, the mohawk. It sounds like Oliver Twist. I'm sorry.
No, Tim's young Ian. Sorry.
Give me one more chance.
It's the first words he's uttered since Bree entered. We know why. He was choking on food.
Yes, he was eating.
He was all consumed. I think that's the thrust of that. And yes, young Ian continues.
I sold him to the mohawk. I'm really sorry. Every time I speak in a Glasgow accent, it's going to end with me just descending into laughter. I'm sorry, everyone.
Oh, sorry, did you just get a Glasgow accent? That was your...
It was a nothing accent.
Specifically Glasgow.
I know, that was an overstretch. That was an overstretch. Let me confess something, and this is no disservice to John Bell. Whenever I see John Bell, I see a young Oliver Twist. He just has that kind of angelic appearance, and in my head, I make those my synapses misfire, and I make that connection.
Well, I offer you this. I put this on the table before you. How about, as we're playing, exploring these characters afresh,
please.
How about if young Ian was actually Cockney? If somehow through his childhood he was adopted by someone from London and he has a Cockney accent. It's a stretch, but I feel like it's the only way it's going to work.
I think it's in my wheelhouse.
I think this is fabulous. This is going to be used somewhere. This is wonderful.
So shall we take it back for you?
Okay, take it back, please. Give me a lead in.
I would love to. Let's take it from Jamie's bonnet and then Bree and then young Ian Stammers. And then with that new knowledge that we are all party to on this podcast, which is very exciting, we'll go straight in. David, I'm very excited for you. Got a lot of backstory there. Should be good. Should be tremendous, in fact.
Can we just really emphasize Stammers? Can we make that really clear for the audience?
Absolutely.
Okay. I'm open to your direction. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you for that direction.
Okay, so here we go. So Jamie stares at it. This is the ring. Jamie stares at it, instantly comprehending the implications, horrified. Bonnet.
Yes. Now where the hell is Roger?
Young Ian Stammers.
Eric, with the mohawk.
Fabulous. Goodness me, that's... Oh, it's like hearing a young Colin Firth. I mean, honestly, that was wonderful. It's the first he's uttered since Brianna entered. Still remembering the stammer, young Ian.
I sold him to the mohawk.
Oh, my God, it's amazing. I think we've just witnessed some next-level stuff here today.
You don't think, you know.
This is sensational.
I have a tear. I mean, I often have a leaky eye in the morning anyway, but I have a tear rolling down my cheek for David Berry's young Ian. In fact, I want to hear more. I think we should find a scene with more young... Anyway, I think.
I'm spent.
Could you give me that line once more, please, David?
I sold him to the mohawk.
You sold him?
Ian looks to Jamie. Help me out here. Without warning, Brianna punches Ian in the face, drawing blood as end scene. Gentlemen, that was a journey.
Wow.
We went on a journey.
I feel I have really gone somewhere today. I feel Sophie Skelton may never talk to me again, but I think it was worth it for the art.
I think for the sheer joy of that scene and some new things that people may not have got from viewing the original scene, I think we've added a few little elements that will just only enhance and enrich your viewing pleasure.
Yeah. And like you say, I forgot to mention one of the reasons why I chose the scene was the suspense, the tension, which is built throughout not knowing if Murta is going to make that whiskey and if Ian is going to be able to swallow.
Yes.
Rich.
Yes. That's the driver of the scene. People may have thought it's Jamie and where is Roger? Could have been sold to the Mohawk. It's not. The drive of the scene is Murta going to get his whiskey? Is Ian going to finish that, I believe, porridge? So that's our gift to the listening public. A little extra something there, a little extra.
I've got to ask, so after we finish this scene, what usually happens is the director comes to you, if you're lucky, and says, how do you feel about it? How did you feel about reading Brianna specifically? Is that something you've always dreamed?
That's something that I dream of on an almost nightly basis, especially when we're filming, we're on set. I come away and think, I could have done that much, much better. And I have often asked the director on set if I could have a go at it. Just even if you're not going to put it on camera, if you're not at least going to shoot some B on it, then at least let me demonstrate how it should be and then we can move on. But then it never goes too well. Often people find it insulting and I'm not about offending people. I'm just all about making the scene the best it can be. I want to collaborate creatively with everyone, even if that means, you know, getting in the skin of the character of the other actor I'm working on set with. I don't find it offensive. I just, you know, we're all there to do great work and whatever gets us there, really, at the end of the day.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you're one of those actors that like to give notes to other actors.
I don't. I like to suggest notes, not give them. Offer. I'll hold them here. Here's my note in my hand. You can come over and you can have a look at this note. Mm-hmm. You can take it if you don't.
Which just says do it better.
It usually just says be better.
You're not going to do that on the day, are you? Just a casual suggestion.
Well, if we're giving a note, who are we giving a note to? I'm up for notes. Tim, are you up for notes?
I'm always up for notes. I mean, I don't need them, but I'm always up for them.
Richard, I don't even know if you've seen either of us act, but we are on a show with you called Outlander. And we would really love, I think we would benefit from any notes that you could give either Tim or I.
From scene 13?
No, just in our work in general, or scene 13. Don't limit yourself.
Or your work in general?
Please.
Oh, God, I feel too much pressure because there's so much.
There's so much to get through.
There's so much potential within both of you. But even still, you know, creative potential and potential output of just really great work that I couldn't. I don't want to be responsible for steering you in the wrong direction because you are both such great, talented actors. If you were shit or mediocre, I would give you notes all day, knowing that it probably wouldn't make a difference. But I know that my notes to you may influence you on your creative journeys, and I am not in a position where I want to take on that responsibility because apart from anything else, you're both friends as well as colleagues. So I can't do that.
Well, yeah. We're all very self-congratulatory. Tory here, aren't we, Tim?
Okay, we'll give you one note, and it's on diction.
Yes.
So oh, this again.
Coming on to a podcast.
Congratulatory.
A little vocal warm-up and some articulation exercises would work for you, David.
Well, that takes me back to drama school.
You're coming across, you sound a little Australian.
yes, you also sound a little Aussie. If we could just make that less so.
Did you go to drama school?
Yes, in Glasgow, yeah.
Okay, and what was that experience like for you? Take us through drama school. Where were you as a young actor?
Oh, now you sound like a journalist. Where was I as a young actor? What was... See, I thought it was really bizarre at first, in first year specifically. I remember doing both my first movement class and my first vocal class, my first voice class, and thinking, what am I doing? Because movement class, for anyone who's never done a movement class, well, I'd imagine most people who aren't actors and haven't done any sort of drama school, they liked you to. It's about being clear of your inhibitions and being more aware of your body, being more aware of the physicality of your body. And to do that, you go through various exercises, and some of them are really silly, varying from researching and inhabiting an ape, for example. We often do animals at drama school. And also just some really silly exercises to free yourself up of kind of inhibitions and tensions. And some of the things you do can be throwing yourself around the floor, getting into some really sort of, some really strange, awkward sort of positions with your fellow classmates to do various sort of still tableaus and things like that. They're very, really weird exercises, especially in first year. And it is mainly about being, you know, comfortable with each other and kind of dusting away those kind of inhibitions that you're going to have, especially as you first walk through the door. Voice class as well, I remember finding particularly strange because I didn't see the point in most of what we were doing. I didn't see the point in it. And I questioned it and I thought, this isn't for me. I don't know what I thought I was about to start doing. I don't know what I thought I was about to start studying, but this isn't it. I just want to be an actor. But now I realize, you know, in hindsight, reflecting back on all of that stuff, especially the stuff in first year, I realized the importance of it. I realized the foundation that was laying. I really genuinely do understand how important all of that vocal and movement and physical work is to character. You're basically laying the foundation of bringing yourself to a point where you can be more creative. You understand the process that goes into a character physically and vocally, if that makes sense. I've just rambled and tried to put first year in its entirety into a nutshell.
I relate 100% to what you said. I don't know about you, Tim, but from my personal experience, my first year in drama school, I spent, I think it was 2 months doing animal work where I had to get in the ins and outs of being a cane toad, And the way that we got to that is that we...
Sorry, can
we
you talk back to Cane Toad and explain what Cane Toad
is? Well, I will.
Is,
okay. So
I.e. me.
We had movement class. We always had to do the strange thing of putting on tights. I never really enjoyed that, but I don't know. That's beside the point. First year, one of the topics was you had to do animal work. And so we got assigned animals. And this sounds a little bit kind of a humble brag, but I'm going to say it anyway. You had to choose something that was the opposite of what you are, because that's what first year's all about, trying to expand your horizons and stretch yourself as much as you can. And my teacher said, you have to find the ugliest thing possible, which was kind of a nice compliment to me. It's like obviously saying that, well, I'm not the ugliest thing imaginable.
Which is absolute antithesis to you.
Yes,
obviously.
Yes. I told you it sounded like a terrible humble brag.
David Berry.
Thank you.
I get you. Thank I can
you.
See the
I didn't want to lead you to that logic, but there you found it yourself. So I had to find the ugliest thing. So we went to the Taronga Zoo in Sydney and I was looking for animals and I found a cane toad. A cane toad is a species of toad that looks, it's disgusting. And I don't know, look one up on the internet, you'll see it. They're a major pest here, and mostly in Queensland. But I spent 2 months just hunched over as a cane toad trying to figure out animal work.
2 months? You spent two months as a cane toad?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 2 months.
That is absolutely extraordinary. It reminds me that those first years of being different animals or being a tree, the classic, you're an actor, you're being a tree and kind of, you know, either like you're a young tree, you're a sapling. You're growing. You're now sort of a middle-aged tree. You're now sprouting. It's spring. It's summer. It's winter. Oh, it's winter. Now you're an old tree. All that kind of stuff. But the main one that I remember was a period movement class.
Oh,
where
wow.
We had this very old period movement teacher who...
That's a period movement class. Yeah. Hold on. What's a period? That sounds like something that you don't do in a UK. I never had those classes.
You never had period movement?
No.
It was brilliant. It was absolutely brilliant. And she would say, right, okay, you're now going to do like a restoration piece or a Shakespeare piece or something like that. How would you move? How would you walk and things of that nature? Right. And it was very useful. Apart from this one lesson where she said, and she had, and she looked like Dame Barbara Cartland. And if you know what Dame Barbara Cartland looks like, she's kind of like painted white face, sort of blue rinse hair, almost wearing like a kind of rough, very high neck sort of Victorian dress, that kind of thing. Woman in her late 70s. And just say, okay, so now the ladies will walk around the room and it's winter. And of course, when the ladies walk around the room, they would have lots of accessories, hats, shoes, gloves, the like. And of course, she would also carry her muff. And we went, what?
What?
Because obviously the ladies would obviously, as winter, would carry their muff. Right, and what, you know, obviously then you start going, okay, and what do they put in their muff? Well, the ladies obviously put their hands in their muff. Right, right, okay, and can other people put their hands in their muff? Oh, well, I do. Well, it depends, it's a very cold winter, so if you met a male friend, he obviously could put his hand in your muff. if it meant to keep warm, obviously being very cold. She obviously just didn't get it. So we were just going on and on and on about sort of saying, are they different sizes? What are they? I mean, what does it kind of feel like? Well, they can obviously vary. Some muffs can be very smooth. Some are very hairy. All depending on what animal, of course, they are. And this has stuck with me for 20 plus years because it was just the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard in my entire life. And I loved every second of it. That was my experience. God bless
you. You know, it's
her.
Interesting you said about period movement because I was looking at a picture of what I was doing yesterday and what you were doing. There's a picture of you and Tim and I side by side. And I was looking at our body language, hands behind the back. Hands behind the back. That's all you have to do to achieve period movement, I reckon. She should have taught you that in one class and you could get through any period piece. If you're a man, just hands behind the back. Kevin O'Tryon, hands behind the back. Lord John, hands behind the back. And you don't have to worry about what your hands are doing. I don't know what Roger's doing though, because you have to worry about your hands. That's one thing I think as an actor you're always thinking about is your hands, right? What are you doing with your hands?
Or don't. Try not to be too aware of them, but I know exactly what you mean, especially early on, as you're sort of working on your craft, as you're developing as an actor. Mm. That is one thing. As soon as you're put on stage the first sort of few times, or on television, if you're doing that, is you become extremely aware, hyper aware of your extremities. All of a sudden, you're like, oh my God, I have hands. Oh my God, what are they doing? Why are they, what do I normally do with these limbs? Where should they go? In my pocket, yeah, that's cool. I look pretty cool now. Nope, that's not going to work. I need to vary this up somehow. And then you start trying to think of other things to do with your hands, and they become, you become super aware of them. I think the trick is to, sounds really strange because someone says think elephant, you think elephant, but try not to be aware of your hands.
Or use a good nut.
I don't know. They do become these massive things, I think, before you sort of develop the experience that they should be there. They should just be there.
They should. Yeah. I remember I was doing a period show, or I couldn't put my hands behind my back, and I was putting my hands in my pocket. And apparently that was a no-go zone. You couldn't put your hands in your pocket because apparently people didn't use pockets back in the 50s. And I just couldn't understand that logic until I finally found out half the reason they didn't want me to use the pockets is because the costume department didn't like what it looked like when you put your hands
in your pocket. They never do. They never do. So there you go, acting 101.
Mm.
We've learned today, I believe, something you should tackle early on is learn how to use your hands.
Absolutely. And you can put your hands in a lady's muff if she lets you. That is what I took from that.
And if it's extremely cold.
And if it's extremely cold. That I cannot stress enough. Anything else, that's dubious. But in a period piece, absolutely, that's a go.
But not, preferably not in your pockets if you're asking the costume department.
Absolutely. I think the great artist of our time who has obviously heeded that is Jeff Goldblum, who is a constant...
Yeah, but he's great. His hands... It's always to be emphatic, isn't it? It's always to be... He does it in... Well, I mean, it's a very Jeff Goldblum way, isn't it? It's very unique to him.
Very, very much is. I mean, you just look at Jurassic Park. That man could not be further away from a pocket. Whereas Sam Neill, one hand in the pocket.
Yeah.
That's another way to watch Jurassic Park. See who's got their hands in their pockets. And
actually,
who hasn't.
Anything. Outlander. Watch it. Who's got the hands in the pockets? Who's got the hands behind the back? Who's doing what with their hands?
It's a whole different chart. According to David Berry, all of them have their hands behind their back.
Well, if they're English, if they're English and performing to a horrible cliche, then they, me, I exclude you, Tim, from that. They've got their hands behind their back.
Thank you.
Like me.
Well, that is now what I'm going to be thinking the next time I do any sort of period character, when my go-to will be to have my hands behind my back. I'm going to think, no, this is just not good enough. This is not going to cut it for today. I now know that this is a default setting, especially of David Berry's, and I'm going to try and be a bit more creative with it and come up with something better than just standing here with my hands behind my back. That's no criticism of you or your performance or your generic period mode, but I'm just going to try and be better. So you have inspired me from this moment on. If you ever see me in a period piece, I'm going to give you something, and it's going to be a credit to you, David.
Oh, that's good. And we mustn't forget as well, within the period piece, the different hierarchies. So, for instance, if you're clergy, you don't put your hands behind your back. You put your hands in front.
Right.
And if you're, say, like an abbot, you would have your hands higher.
This come from someone who's played member of the clergy?
Do you know what? I don't want to throw names around, but I'm going to. When I was in Wolf Hall, that's right, when I was in Wolf Hall with Mark Rylance, that's right, we did a period class. And it was mainly to show us how the Tudors bow, because you would assume you bow forward, but the Tudors actually bow backwards. So they kind of put their weight on the back and then kind of bow down and then come back. So we learn all these kind of little things and about where hands go for different hierarchies and different stratas of society. Nobleman, hands behind the back. Clergy, hands in front. If you're a higher up, a cardinal or something, you hold your hands higher. There's a whole kind of thing about it. But again, the best thing that I got from it was that the Tudors used to eat everything on toast. So they would present this incredible goose or this great feast. And you go, that looks absolutely magnificent. I can't wait to really, really get involved in that. And they would take it away to the cupboard. They would take it to the cupboard, which is a table where they would literally keep cups because you weren't allowed anything on the table, the cupboard, the cupboard. They would cut it up into little squares and put everything on toast, then bring you back. And so you would reach in and take, and so everything was eaten on toast. How amazing is that?
That's brilliant.
Isn't that incredible? That's so those kind of classic things like, yeah.
Freshly caught piece of game.
This leads me to another question. Look, I don't like to sound like a journalist, Rick, but we like to take you through the who, what, why, where, when, how on this show. I like to ask people what they eat for breakfast.
Do you know, that causes me endless amounts of stress in the morning because I like to try and vary it up. I like to try and have, you know, change things up in the morning. I know that there are a whole, you know, smorgasbord of things available to you in the morning. And I like to try and...
Not just toast.
No, not just toast. Not just toast and roast duck, for example.
exactly.
But, you know,
breakfast of kings.
That point where the runner comes in, I'm usually in the makeup because we're usually, most of my days on Outlander on season 5 started really, really quite early, in fact, pre-breakfast. So I was often sitting in makeup. One of our runners would come in and ask what we want for breakfast. And it would always really stress me out. So I would open it out to the floor to see what everyone else thought I should have for breakfast. I'm quite suggestible that way. Sophie would often suggest...
Communal suggestion.
Yeah, like scrambled eggs and toast. And I thought, oh, that's a good idea. Does anyone have a better idea? Because I'm really shit at deciding what I'm having for breakfast. That sounds really weird, I'm sure, but...
Yeah, why? I want to get inside the psychology. Why are you very speaking indecisive. About it?
I should really speak to someone about it. I don't know why. Yeah.
Well, speak to I us. I'm qualified. Tim, are you qualified?
I'm more than qualified.
But I just think generally when presented with too many options, I can be quite indecisive. It's like I will sit, stare at the Netflix menu for about an hour. I'll have an hour and a half to watch something good on television and spend an hour of that hour and a half trying to decide what it is that I should watch. Because there's too many things. I've seen myself Google, what should I watch on Netflix? Because I can't decide. And I'll look up top 20 shows right now to watch right now, not top 20 shows ever or top 20 shows of the past decade, but top 20 shows right now in Richard's living room to watch on Richard's television. Often that returns zero results, but I will try.
That's true. I don't think you're alone in that. I have the opposite problem in the morning. It's not about how many things to choose. I kind of know what I want to choose. My problem is actually saying what I want a lot of the time. And I feel slightly embarrassed about it because it is a little bit of an embarrassing thing to ask for. It's very specific. I like to have an egg white omelet, but with a specific number of eggs. It's got to be 5 egg whites and it's got to have peppers, onions, and no cheese and whatever vegetables they can throw in. And you throw that to the caterers at Outlander and you just hope that they're going to, first of all, take that order without any level of like, contempt for your particularity and actually understand what you're asking for. Because as I've come to discover that the food in Glasgow is not the best. It's not really the same kind of thing that I've come to expect in Australia.
Depends where you eat, mate. Remember, well, you are speaking to a Glaswegian guest on your show.
I am speaking to and I think
where you go and it depends on, you know, what your particular tastes, obviously. And
well, if I were to ask you for
please, for example. So, you know, we won't get into
that's this. Going wrong.
Glasgow has some of the finest food in the UK. We have one of everything, one of every cuisine here in Glasgow. You can have a great Mexican. No, you can't. You can't have a great Mexican.
Okay, nearly everyone.
Indian, though, you can have great Italian food. You can have great French food. You can have great Japanese food. You can have great traditional fare, all in Glasgow. All on the same bloody street, mostly. It's all in Finiston, really. But some of the best food I have eaten. So I take no offence. Everyone's entitled to their opinion, David. But I'm just saying, I'm giving you some examples.
See, this is clearly what's happening. I'm asking for a 5 egg white omelette and causing offence to very sensitive Glaswegians who are very proud of their food. And coming back with, I usually open it up and it's nothing what I've asked for, but I'll eat it happily.
The one thing I really like, I usually go full English because I don't usually have it here. So I always think I'm on holiday, even though I'm working, so I'll have a full English, regardless of what I'm doing, regardless of it. What if I'm hungry, regardless of the fact of even if I want it, even if it's nice. But one of the best things actually about filming in Scotland is my dad's Scottish. My dad's from Edinburgh. So I have been brought up on brown sauce. Mm. So in other words, when they say, do you want a sausage sandwich or a bacon sandwich or something like that? In England, they'll usually say, do you want ketchup? No, I don't want ketchup. Why on earth would I want ketchup with that? Whereas in Scotland, they'll say, would you like brown sauce? Yes, I absolutely would. That's how you have a sausage sandwich or a bacon sandwich, bar none. Whereas down here, they don't do it. Up north, yes, they do. And that's my, that's probably why I go for full English all the time when I'm up on the Outlander sector. You go, yep, brown sauce, fabulous.
Yeah, I'm often confused when I see people asking for or choosing to put ketchup on their bacon sandwich because I think that's not one of the ingredients of that dish.
And you're absolutely right. It goes with chips, not a problem.
Yeah, oh yeah,
it doesn't. It doesn't go. Oh, you need goodness. That vinegary tang.
I am just in the wrong company here. I don't. First of all, I don't even know what brown sauce is, and I have to say, when I was perplexed when I came to the British Isles and at the food choices. I don't want to go too far in this topic about the food and Glasgow, but I was astonished to see how many things you could get fried in Scotland, including but not limited to pizza and Mars bars. Amazing.
Have you ever tried a deep fried Mars bar, though, David?
I have. Look,
it's incredible. Although I will say halfway through a deep fried Mars bar, as incredible as it is, you can feel literally in the moment, feel your blood pressure rise.
Yeah.
You can feel blood pumping through your body. It's your heart.
It's like halfway through. If you were asked the moment you thought you had diabetes, I could place it to a time and a place.
Yeah.
And everything. You know, middle of the Edinburgh Fringe. It was probably about 3 a.m. And I think I suddenly got diabetes then. That's usually when most people get it.
Okay. But in answer to your question, David, I will normally have some sort of eggs, scrambled eggs. Poached eggs.
Okay. So you've had the eggs, you're in costume, you've got a scene. Let's say you've got a big scene. What's your end of this character? What are you doing?
Well, I mean, that's... It's quite a broad sort of question.
I want to lift the curtain a bit. I want to see what's inside Richard Rankin's process.
Well, I think the process when you're coming to your, I don't know what, your third or fourth season and something, how you prepare for your character, how you take your character through a scene and, you know, your process through that's very much different to if you're coming onto something for the first time or if you're coming onto something as, you know, a guest, or if you have one episode or something. I think the process is very different because I think you prepare your character differently. I did a lot of work back in season 2 before I started for the season 2 finale. Roger first appears in episode 13 of season 2, which is the ultimate episode of season 2. And I did a lot of work, I did a lot of research on the character, a lot of prep, I did a lot of work. I actually took myself off to Inverness, which is where Roger was from, where he was brought up, spent a couple of weeks there. I even rented a tiny little single bed room. And I mean single bed, it's a British single bed, which is the width literally of a person. Not an American single bed, which is basically our double beds. But, you know, it's a tiny little box room. And I went and I did a lot of work on my accent, my vocal work, because Roger, well, when I started with the character, he did have an Invernessian accent. I don't know what his accent is now. I think sometimes I forget to keep in mind that he's not Glaswegian. But I did a lot of vocal work. I did a lot of work on... Well, a lot of character building, a lot of what makes him, what does he do? So he's an assistant professor of history at Oxford. So he's going to be an orator. He's going to be good at speaking. He's going to be speaking often in front of large classes. He's going to be giving lectures. So I looked up a lot of, this might sound silly, but a lot of recorded lectures at places like Oxford and Cambridge, and lectures giving good talks on things and how, well, on how they presented themselves physically and vocally, and how is that different in that room? You know, how does that change from place to place? How does that change when he's at home? How does that change when he's at work? And how does this form a person? I mean, I'm taking you through. There are many, many, many elements to how you build and approach your character, right? But this is essentially where I started with Roger. The music of the time, the social situation of the 60s, what was going on at those times, and these things all inform your character. So I think what I'm trying to say is, once you've done a lot of that sort of groundwork, which I suppose you could say is essential groundwork to any character, just depends on how much you want to put into it, then that's going to stay with you up until you know, season five. You just have to remember the things that have affected you, that have affected your character throughout his journey up until that point. So to lift the lid on Roger, I think at this point is quite a complex thing, just because we're so far into it now, and I think it's a slightly different thing. But also, as you know, it depends on the scene that you're about to do, right? It depends on what's required of you in the scene that you're about to film. Is it a particularly emotional scene? Do you have to take yourself away into sort of solitude and quietness and really sort of kind of be quite sort of, you know, within yourself? Some scenes require that of you. If you know that you have to be in quite a vulnerable or open state, then I think the last thing that, I mean, all actors are different, right? We all have our own ways of approaching a scene, and we all have our own ways of how we get to where we want to be. But, you know, I think if I'm going to be doing quite an emotionally taxing or vulnerable scene, then the last thing I want to be doing for the scene is jumping around, having a laugh with, you know, my co-stars and colleagues. As Richard, that's the first thing I want to be doing, is standing around a lot, having a laugh with Tim Downey and David Berry. But for my performance, I think I have a responsibility to prepare myself mentally for what it is I'm about to do. But sometimes, as you know, you'll get scenes that are like half a page that you know that you can go on set with. Actually, there are scenes where I will have a quick look at the night before and think, I can do that on the day. I'll take that one to set with me. That might seem a bit complacent, but there are those scenes that you can just go on.
I think this is something that maybe is a hang-up of people who are trained. You know, absolving yourself of that responsibility and that burden of thinking that you have to prepare everything about this character. I remember reading somewhere like Gregory Peck, he used to get scenes where he'd write AR and then other scenes where he put NAR, and that meant AR means acting required and then NAR means no acting required. Like one of those half page scenes where you just come in, you have no, and what he meant by acting is sort of like what you described, getting all that extraneous stuff that you need for character research and all that kind of stuff that you hope can bring and enrich the character and bring something to the screen, but sometimes doesn't always appear on the screen.
Well, yes, absolutely. I think sometimes you can always get too involved in certain things. I'm remembering something that happened to a friend of mine. A friend of mine was told, I think he was doing some Shakespeare, and was told to do a bit of method acting, go out into the community and be the character. Be the character in the community and see how people react to you, and then you can kind of gauge how other actors will react to your character and that kind of thing. So off he went. And this was in North London, near the Wood Green Shopping Centre. So we went off into the Wood Green Shopping Centre, be the character, come back in an hour and tell us what's happened and, you know, talk about your experience. An hour comes and goes, he's not there. 2 hours comes and goes, we're starting to worry. 3 hours comes and goes, okay, this is now quite serious, he hasn't returned. So we send out someone, I think one of the teachers or one of the lecturers, make some phone calls. But anyway, they go into the office and there's a policeman there with said actor who was pleading, saying, I'm an actor, I'm an actor. And his part was to be sort of like a petty thief. So he had gone into an Asda, looked suspicious, and tried to kind of pretend to steal a frozen pie. The security people had said he looked suspicious and arrested him. And he was trying, and then basically he said, yeah, we get a lot of that around here. I'm an actor. There was a drama school, obviously, next door. I'm an actor. I'm sorry. I'm an actor. I'm doing a part. I'm trying to create something. I'm sorry. I haven't tried to steal the Frey Bentos. I wouldn't do that. I'm an actor. Yeah. Of course you are, mate. And he was quite distraught. And it took a long time to convince people that he was an actor. The upshot of this is that he wasn't good enough. Because if you were really a good burglar or a thief, you wouldn't have got caught.
Or you would have committed and you wouldn't have given the game up. You would have said,
absolutely, come away and we could have all feasted on a Frey Bentos, which we haven't had. Very good pie.
No, or he goes to prison and then he really learns. He gets the real education. Or no, you're not going to prison for stealing whatever it is. What did you get? Mentos? Is that what you said?
Frey Bentos.
I don't even know what
it's
that
a
is.
Pie.
I don't even know what a Frey... It's a pie in a tin, David. I don't know.
See, back to food. We don't even know what pies and tins are here. That's
What did you say? A tin pie? Oh my God.
It's even going to blow your mind even more that Fray Bentos is a real place in Uruguay. I know. And that's where they make them.
It's not.
And that's where
it is. Fray Bentos is a place, is like a town in Uruguay that would make these pies in tins. And that's why they're called Fray Bentos.
Did not know that.
I have literally, if you take nothing else away from this podcast, take away
hands,
the fact.
Please. Take the hands as well.
I'm taking away so many things from this podcast.
Yeah.
Can't even tell you.
Can't even begin. It's going to have to be processed. Sit down. I'm going to have a bath and just really
decompress
it down.
Before we let you go, I did have a question I always want to ask. Are you famous?
No, I don't. I mean, within the Outlander sphere, perhaps. But with that, no, I don't consider myself to be. Certainly not something I dwell upon. It's not something that's particularly important to me. But we do get recognised a lot from specifically, you know, especially this season. I'm finding, I don't know if it's because there are more viewers or because the show's more popular or whatever.
If you're not famous, then why do you have such a detailed Wikipedia page? There is so much on you, Richard Harris.
Right, I'm going to admit to you now that I haven't seen it.
You need to look at your Wikipedia.
Nor do I particularly want to see it.
You've never Googled yourself?
No, I tend not to do that. I think that's a slippery slope. I don't really. I'm not that.
I'll admit, I've Googled myself once or twice. It's almost. You can't. How can you not in this day and age?
What are you hoping to find?
Oh, just sort of a curiosity about what exists there on the internet. That if people were to Google me, I'd want to know what they're getting. I remember I got into a bit of a fight with Wikipedia about one of the photos that they put up because I was not happy with the when I googled David Barry. Wikipedia is one of the first hits, right? And there was just this awful photo, and my ego got the better of me, and I was like, I can't have this photo of me on my Wikipedia page. I have to find a way of changing it. So I resubmitted a photo that I thought was a little more flattering. And it was there for maybe a day or two. And then I went back and checked up on it. And then they changed it back. And then you can go and see why they've given you the reasons. And the reason was because I was David Barry myself, that did not entitle me to actually change the photo because I was a partisan in the whole thing. So they said, you can't change this. If you want to get that photo removed, you have to talk to the person directly who put it up. How about that?
Yeah, I mean, that's
crazy.
That's why I don't get involved in that world of things. Basically. But I don't see, I mean, I think Google, it says, I struggle to watch myself, but I struggle to watch things that I've done. Struggle certainly to watch any sort of. I never watch playback, for example. I know some actors do that, but I don't find any benefit. I don't find I gain anything by watching myself. So I certainly don't think I'll gain anything by googling myself. In fact, I think that could only potentially be detrimental when you find out what people actually think of you or what people actually thought of a performance that you thought was good one time, and it's getting slaughtered online. I don't know what benefit there is in that. Just let them do what they want to do online, because they will. People will do what they want to do online, and there's no way to.
Absolutely, absolutely. But it leads me very, very, very well on saying about fame and being recognised, and that is, I think I mentioned this to you, Richard, my mother-in-law forwarded me a message from a friend of hers, all ladies of a certain age, very respectful. She's in South Africa, and she watches Outlander. And she said, oh, yes, you know, I saw you in Outlander and all that. And she said, oh, there's the person that plays is it Roger? Yeah, Roger, Rick, Roger. Oh, right. Yes, no, I recognized him. So, really? What? Obviously, from Outlander, it's everywhere. No, it's not. It's not from that. It was a comedy. Oh, I'll send it to you. She said, I'll send it to you. So she sent me a little sketch where a young, unshaven Richard is sitting in a police car, and two policemen come over to him and he says, sorry, officer, what's happened here? And he says, well, you know, I think you've been speeding or something. Would you suck into this? And then Richard says, no, you blow into these things. And no, you suck this one. You suck this one. Pitch is helium. And he ends up with a very, very high-pitched voice. But basically, she recognized you from that series.
Wow.
That's shown, obviously, get onto your agent, because obviously that was being shown in South Africa. I'm just saying, you know. And and then said, oh, that's how it is. So I think with a lot of being known or fame, it usually comes in the seemingly most unlikely of ways.
Absolutely.
You assume it's something and you kind of go, how on earth has anybody seen this particular
thing? And that, it's starting to make a lot more sense now why I read on your Wikipedia page, for your education, Richard, since you're not going to read it, why it said Richard Rankin, actor and comedian.
Well, that was a great show. That was one of my first jobs. I did a few series of that. It's a show called Burniston, which is a BBC Scotland comedy show, which I think has found its way, you know, through various channels to international acclaim, apparently. But there's a lot of it on YouTube and things. And the boys who wrote it, Robert Florence and Ian Connell, who are great and they're good friends. I mean, they're very talented writers who also star in it. You know, they distribute it often for free and put it out on things like Instagram, Facebook and all that, which is great because they just want to kind of share their work. They are the comedy masterminds behind it. But people often ask me, will you ever return to comedy? I'm like, I don't really see myself as a comedian. I don't think I'm that funny. And they're like, oh my God, stop, you are. And I'm like, no, I'm serious. I don't think I'm that funny. That's not really my sort of genre of acting.
No, you are a very funny man, Richard Rankin.
You are a very funny man.
I'm not funny. I can't help but laugh at that.
But what I was going to say is, it is often in the most unlikely places and unlikely of circumstances you'll bump into people. You'll bump into random people either at home or abroad, and they'll go, you know, that way where someone looks at you and you think, oh, they I think they know me from something. And they look at you and it takes them a while and they go back to what they're doing. But 5 or 10 minutes later, you'll have gone around the supermarket or whatever and they'll come up to you and they'll go, no, I know you. I'm like, yeah, and they're like, I know you. Okay. What do I know you from? Like, which is a question I struggle with.
They're entitled to this answer.
You want me to rhyme my CV to you? I don't know what you know you from. You're the one that has stated to me that you know me. You should find the clarity in that. I'm not gonna find that for you. But anyway, it often ends up being the most unlikely thing, like the thing I did, one of the first things I did in my career, and it is often Burniston. And I think when they say, oh, I know you, I think, oh, is it from, you know, this acclaimed BBC drama that has just aired that I finished filming not so very long ago with X cast, whatever. And they go, no, Burniston. It's Burniston, or it's some random commercial that you've done that you really hoped would never see the light of day.
Yeah.
And they go, no, it's just
what you want.
And one of the most obscure one that's happened once was a Belhaven Best commercial, Belhaven Best advert. And I was like, how are you, what?
Wow.
How? What? How are you even, what? How's that?
How have you pulled? Yeah.
So that's the most obscure thing, but that started in much the same way. Was how do I know you, or where would I know you from? Taxi drivers are the worst for it, so I just don't tell them I'm an actor.
No, what do you do? I tell them
I'm actually an atmospheric effects engineer, and they go, okay.
Wow.
And they just drive. Because they tend not to probe too far into it.
I sometimes get where someone will come up to me and say, I know, you know, same scenario, I know you, and you go, oh God, this is awkward. Oh, and you kind of go, right, okay, I'm looking at you. Maybe you would have seen this, maybe you would have seen that, and I'm thinking this. And they say, did you work in Halfords? And you go, what? Because you look familiar, but they can't quite place you. Or did they say, were you in Mrs. Brown's class at Ickleford Juniors in about 1986? No. What on earth are you talking about? Because you're very familiar. Is it Tesco's? You ever work in Tesco's? Because I feel like, well, WH Smith? No? Well, I don't know. And then you'll say you're an actor. They go, no, not really. No. anyway, bye. And they'll leave. Well, I have had that, which they were disappointed that I didn't work in Halfords. I think they were obviously thinking, I need some, you know, new hubcaps. This is the guy that works in Halfords. He can do me a deal.
Well, Richard Rankin, you're one of the most famous people I know. I'm privileged to know.
Tricky Dicky. I think we've definitely gone through that and now know why. But thank you. thank you so much for your time and the little insights for the scenes. Wonderful Brie work. Let's bring us back to that. Some fabulous, fabulous stuff there that will live on in the annals of Outlander history.
The only acting I'm going to get to do for months. So thank you for giving me that opportunity, truly, from my heart.
I just want to try a little something. It's on this on Instagram Live.
Well, they say you're only as good as your last performance, and they'll be busting down the door after that performance.
Well, thank you, gentlemen. It's been an honour and a pleasure. I said something similar, but not quite that at the start. I had a great time chatting to you both. I hope.
Good.
I wish
good. It's been an absolute pleasure. Richard Rankin, thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks, guys.
Welcome to Listener's Questions, where we'll have a little rummage to our inbox and see what you've written to us. So this is a wonderful letter. This one is from Doris and Richard, who say, hello, we are just celebrating, love the podcast, by the way, and are just celebrating our 80th wedding anniversary. Goodness me.
Oh,
Oak,
congratulations.
I think that's Oak. Well done. Congratulations.
Wow.
Very much enjoyed Diana's episode, especially the sex chat. Mm-hmm. Interesting. After having been married for so long, we have decided to really spice things up in the bedroom.
Okay.
So we've started to read Outlander and want some suggestions as to what can really set light to the sheets, as it were. My husband has introduced a large vibrating egg.
Okay.
What can I do to bring the goods? Hope you can help.
Oh, well.
Thanks very much.
Wow.
Well, okay. Richard, I think it's Richard, really seems to have things in hand. I suppose a few things is, what does he do with this large vibrating egg? Is it insertion? Is it sort of around the and ram it in? I don't know how big you are, but if you can insert a holding the egg and maybe keep it there for a while, I think that could only be a good thing.
Well, I think you've come to the right place for advice. I mean, having spoken to Diana, we definitely know our stuff. And I think, Richard, what you want to do is to grab a really juicy and you want to put it in your you want to lick it, and then you want to all over your
hope that helps.
And always remember, kids, safe sex all the time. Remember, use protection.
Absolutely. They don't want to walk in and see all that skin flapping around. Thank you for listening to Outcasts.
Please remember to rate, subscribe, and leave a review, as it all helps.
Follow us on our Instagram page at outcast.podcast for all the latest updates.
Or you can send us an email at outcastspodcastshow@gmail.com.
Every week, we shall select a question from one of our listeners to answer on the show.
The theme music is composed by Kieran Ledwidge. All views and opinions expressed on the show are our own and have no affiliation with the series of books written by Diana Gabaldone or the Sony Stars television show Outlander.
No animals were harmed in the making of this podcast. Although I did have a ham sandwich earlier, so.
See you next time.
See you next time.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.